You are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indy Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL, Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Begee on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and FM 100.7. Each week, my co-host Ellen Little and I didn't say O'Neill, Ellen.
It's okay.
Ellen Little and I, we sit here, and this studio, thank you, Paul, has become part of our living room to give back to our community. It's like community service room. That's what it's become.
Yes, it is.
So thank you very much for the opportunity. We do know that freedom of speech comes with a responsibility. And every time we sit here, we try to give out valuable information and educate the public about things that are going on around the nation and right here in Brevard County, Florida, and sometimes in the world. I actually had somebody who called me from Ireland that wants to call in and speak about his documentary again. So we have people from all over the world that are calling us. So Ellen, today we have an action-packed studio, and I'm going to let you tell our listeners on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends who's on our show today.
Oh, that's very exciting.
You get the pleasure of introducing a very important gentleman.
Yes. Well, first of all, the segment today is sponsored by
MedFast, Urgent Care Centers,
and by Lindsay Sharp with Sharp and Die Law.
That's right.
She's going to sponsor her segment. And today we have with us Sheriff Wayne Ivey, who is running for re-election. We're not going to talk much about the election, as I hear, but we're going to talk about some really good stuff. And then we have Lindsay Sharp with us here from Sharp and Die Law down in Indy Atlantic.
Indy Atlantic.
Absolutely.
Right. And, you know, Sheriff, well, thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my honor. Yeah, always enjoy coming on with you. It's been a little bit since I had the opportunity to get by and see everybody in the studio, but always enjoy being on here and sharing information with our citizens.
Thank you. And Lindsay, again, thank you for supporting the show and being here today with us as well.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You are welcome. So before we go to our guests, you know, we always do a little bit of Sita-isms at the beginning of our show. Mm-hmm. And today I just want to say my heart is breaking for all the people all over the United States, the human beings all over the world who are dying of this big, bad COVID disease. And, of course, they had comorbidities. Not people have issues before they get to that point. They've got diagnosis of all sorts of diseases. But what breaks my heart, Ellen, is the fact that so many people cannot bury their loved ones. They cannot hold their hands. They can't. I understand that family members are picking and choosing who can go to the crematorium. They're picking and choosing who can be at a funeral. And that is, to me, is heartbreaking. So I want to tell all our friends who are listening and people all over the world who tune into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, every day we wake up is a good day. And we should not let political affiliations, race, religion divide us. We really shouldn't. There are some people on our country, in actually all over, who uses these things to divide. And I don't want to do that. I have friends who are Republicans. I have friends who are Democrats. I have friends who are independents. And I've known them before, just like I've known our good sheriff for years. And I'm not going to give up my friendships because we disagree on something politically. I think it's wrong. I think at some point, the good Lord gave all of us the senses to see, to smell, to think, to talk, and to, in other words, communicate. So we should. And we can agree to disagree, and we could do it peacefully, and we could do it as human beings.
I think we just lost the fact of perspective. Like, in this day and age, like, kind of everybody's right, you know? I mean, whether you want to wear masks or not, you're right. You know, if you want to be Republican or Democrat, just go vote. That's all we care about, right, is just to, and whatever your opinion is, you obviously have a stance on your opinion, unless you're breaking the law. Other than that, I mean, everybody's right in having their opinion, and we should be able to respect each other's perspectives.
Well, I think that's the thing. Trust and respect. It goes hand in hand. Yeah, and Sheriff, that's one of the things I like about you is that I've known you since you were doing stuff for human trafficking. And I always trusted what you had to say. And you were always putting our community first. So I'm going to let you introduce yourself to our listeners. Well, everybody knows who you are, but it's always nice to say, like, you know, how long have you been a sheriff and what did you do before that?
Yeah, so absolutely.
And, how long have you been the chief law enforcement officer in Brevard?
Yeah, well, I've been blessed to be serving a sheriff for Brevard County for 7.5 years, but I've been a law enforcement officer for 40 years. And, you know, when you're running an agency of this size, experience matters. It counts. And I was blessed as I started my career. Never imagined that I would do all the different things I did. And I always tell people, you think you shape your career, but really your career shapes you.
Right.
And, what happened to me along the way is I started in corrections, working as a corrections deputy, worked in patrol, worked in investigations, worked homicide, narcotics, sex crimes, public integrity, got into the leadership role, did budgeting, had a chance to do all of that. And now I've had a chance to serve as sheriff for 7.5 years. And every day is a new challenge that's thrown at you. But I will tell you that the greatest thing for me is twofold. I'm surrounded by an amazing agency that knocking it out of the park every day to keep our citizens safe. And we're surrounded by a great community that keeps us and protects us just as much as we protect them. So ask for anything better.
How do you keep up being the top cop?
Believe it or not, I wake up every morning about 4:30, 5 o'clock. I spend about an hour doing emails to try and get at least a little bit caught up. Head out the door, and my day usually ends around 9:30, 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And that's Monday through Saturday. I try and take Sundays off. Don't always work out that way, but I try and take Sunday off, and not just to recharge my batteries, but to spend some quality time with my family and get some honeydews caught up around the house, because I'm always behind on those too. So, but I think the biggest thing for me is I love this job. I really and truly get up every day and can't wait to wear this uniform to be with the members of our agency.
And that's wonderful when you put the uniform on and you love what you do. It's like me with nursing or any one of us who wear that uniform. But you know what? I was talking to a friend of mine at the gym, and we were talking about the crime rate in Brevard County has dropped. So what do you contribute to that? I mean, we know that there are less victims, and is it what you're being, I would say, proactive?
You're exactly right. There's a couple factors that go into it. And to answer the question, our crime rate in the past 7.5 years has dropped 33%, which is profound. And again, I credit it to a very proactive agency that, as I tell everyone, we target criminals. I don't make any apology about that. Criminals target our citizens. They victimize us, and so we go after criminals, and we make sure that they can't hurt anybody else. So a very proactive agency. Also, without question, a community that helps us prevent, solve, investigate crimes. And the key word in all of that is prevent, because the true way to lower your crime rate is to prevent the crime from ever occurring. So we developed a good, strong partnership with our citizens. We make them aware of the different crime trends that are taking place, bring education and awareness to the table, and they become the first line of defense for them and their families. And so they're able to prevent the crime, which in turn lowers our crime
rate.
But there's one other aspect to it as well, and this is often lost. It's often forgotten about. And that other aspect is, what's happening to those that are getting arrested? Are they getting right back out and getting into trouble again? Or are you able to rehabilitate them? And one of the things that we've looked at is doing it on both ends, being proactive on one end and being proactive on the back end, and making sure that we're giving them opportunities to succeed when they get out of jail to not only have the right resources they need. Perhaps they're in jail because of domestic violence, so we're getting them some anger management training and those type of things, but also working through great partnerships to get them jobs. We just did a program about a year and a half ago in partnership with ABC Home Builders. The construction market is through the roof, building businesses, homes, everything mm-hmm. else. The biggest problem our contractors have is they can't find laborers. So to get a job on a construction site, you have to have OSHA 10 training. Well, we have a captive audience at the jail. So what we decided to do was offer the OSHA 10 training at the jail. Actually teach the inmates the OSHA 10 training.
And it's productive.
So when they get out, yeah. they can go get a job, and we give them a resource list of contractors that'll hire them, even with the type of background they may have. So we're trying to work it from both ends, being dynamic in our approach and making sure that we're not only getting them taken off the streets where they can't victimize anybody else, making sure that when they go back on the street, they can be a productive member of society.
Right, and that's what we want. We all talk about prison reforms, and that is part of it.
Yeah.
Is getting people ready so that when they come out, they can be part of society again.
That's exactly right.
So, you know, last time you were on our show, we were talking about one slogan that you have used that we all like. We all know the foundation for everything starts at home. But you had said to us, and it stuck with me, and I actually sent it to one of my friends who's a commissioner of police. I sent it, that you have to be the top cop at home.
Right. Yeah. You know, you have to be the chief law enforcement officer in your household. Where I grew up at, my mom was the sheriff, the judge, and the executioner at our household. And my father was her backup and her witness to what happened. And, you know, mom didn't play. I'm to this day, I am respectfully fearful of my mom.
I see, Lindsay, you could jump in here because you know what we, as parents, we are.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, when I look back on my upbringing, and Lindsay could probably add to this, my mom and dad held me accountable for my actions, but the key word in what they did was reasonable. They were reasonable in their approach to how they disciplined us, and you know, I'm a much better person today because of that. And so if you wanted to look at how we really fix some of the things going wrong in society, it is to re-empower mama to be mama. Let mom get back to being mom.
That was my favorite thing in that Baltimore riot that happened. Remember when that mom went in and yanked that kid out by the hoodie right in the middle of everything? She didn't care. All that other rioting was going on. She just snatched him right up and dragged his butt home.
Yeah. That's right.
Exactly.
It was like, right. So Lindsay,
that was awesome. One of us could see that happening to us,
oh,
too.
Totally. Yeah. My little 4'11" mom just dragged me out.
Absolutely.
If you want to add to that, you can.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, I think it's important as parents to really try to get to know your children. I mean, they're all individual. You know, they're all different. I have 6 children. 2 of my 6 are here with me today, my 2 sons. And Sheriff made a comment that they look alike prior to starting this. They do, but they're so different, you know. And I think that we have to kind of base our approach to our children on what we think will work with them. Based on their own sort of personality and their own thought process and critical thinking skills and so forth. So it's important to get to know your own child separate and apart from the others.
Yeah, and Lindsay, that's a great point because, you know, one of the things that parents often do is they don't sit down and talk to their kids. Ronald Reagan said one time that the next great idea for our country will start in conversation at the dinner table. So much of that is lost today, you know, and so a lot of times parents will sit down with their kids and they're trying, they're making the effort to do it and wanting to do it. And they'll say, how was your day? And the child will respond, my day was fine. And that's the end of the conversation.
Right. Did only elaborate, like, yeah, what is fine.
Exactly. And I don't know what fine means to y'all, but I know at my household, if I ask my wife how her day was and she says fine,
there's something wrong.
There's something wrong. Yeah. And so we need to take that even further and start, you know, having that, as Lindsay said, having that great conversation about, well, what was fine about your day? Right. What was your favorite part? What didn't go well?
Right.
Those type of things.
Exactly.
Well, you know, we are seeing, you know, where people have to work 2 jobs. Sometimes we have parents working long hours. They don't have time for the dinners anymore.
That's right.
But I think people should make maybe a couple of days a week, make it a must, where you sit down and talk, because that's the only time some people get to see their kids.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, Sheriff, talking about kids, Brevard County schools are slated to open pretty soon, and we're having all this discussion about COVID-19. And we trust you. You're the top law enforcement guy in our town.
Thank you.
What are we doing? What would you be doing to ensure safety for our children, the parents, and those of us who we don't have anybody in school? We're grandparents, but we're worried.
Right. Well, you know, certainly COVID-19 has thrown a whole new dynamic at us from a security and safety standpoint. If we look at schools starting back under normal circumstances, what we see is us turning our attention to facility security, us turning our attention to traffic flow and school bus stops and the things that we normally see, you know, and would be our messaging. Today, we have a whole new dynamic of
a new
of
normal
safety concerns, a new norm.
New norm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so our team is working, as you know, in 2014, we took over as Director of School Security here in Brevard Public Schools. So our team is working hand in hand with Dr. Mullins and his team to develop the strategies that are going to take place in school. And then, as with anything else, our job will be to implement those safely within the community, to implement those safely within each school, And then Monday morning quarterback, what's happening is it working? Is there some way that we need to adjust and do some things differently? But right now, the biggest focus is I know working with them to try and make sure that the plan is in place and be able to get our kids, our teachers, everyone safely. That's the key word, safely.
People are very anxious, Sheriff.
They are. Emotions are high, and I think that probably ties into some of the things that Lindsay is going to talk about. Emotions are high. Stress is high. People understand that our children benefit from being in school, not only from the academic side, but they benefit from the socialization side of it. Mom and dad are able to work and do the things that they need to do. And so a lot of different stressors in place, and I think those are all going to play a part in how the school decides when we go back and at the abilities for us to go back.
And do you see the school resource deputies playing an additional role in the lives of our children?
Oh, they sure do. You know, when people talk about school resource deputies in today's time, they become focused or even fixated, if you will, on the deputy is there to keep an active shooter from happening at the school. That is just one small part of that school resource deputy's responsibility. They're there to protect that campus in all aspects, not just from an active shooter. Certainly, that's the last thing we ever want to see happen on one of our campuses anywhere, not just in Brevard County, but anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last thing you want to see. But that school resource deputy has far-reaching tentacles into those schools and into those students' lives. And if you look at the ability for us to get to these kids before they get to us, for us to have an impact in helping coach them, direct them, mentor them, rescue them, and be an extension for their parents and their teachers, man, what a great opportunity. In fact, I will tell you that in today's world, being a school resource deputy is one of the most important components of law enforcement because it's the first opportunity to get to these kids before they get in trouble, to get to these kids before somebody else gets to them and drags them into trouble, and to be there for them when they do get in trouble.
Well, yeah, and a lot of kids don't have guidance at home. And so the school resource officer become that person that you, it's your go-to person.
That's right.
You develop a relationship,
yeah,
trust.
I'll tell you, anytime we talk about moving school resource deputies around, you know, hey, this one's going to transfer to this school, I know that I'm about to get bombarded with emails from the faculty and the principal and the teachers at the school going, you're not taking our school resource deputy. They know everybody on campus. The kids love so-and-so.
Relationship
yeah.
they've developed.
And if you want to see a true example of the value of a school resource deputy, it comes from a man, a very, very close friend of mine, who, speaking of him, brings me almost to tears, a man by the name of Adrian Moss Beasley, who was a deputy sheriff for us. And those in this area know Adrian very well. He was a high school football standout at Cocoa,
mm-hmm.
played ball at West Virginia, served in many different roles in Brevard County Sheriff's Office. Deputy, worked at the port, worked at the courthouse. But without question, his living legacy of being a deputy was his time he spent as a school resource deputy. And when Adrian passed cancer, he lost his battle to cancer. When Adrian passed, I put him up on Facebook on our social media site, and I shared his career. And there were thousands of comments from teachers and students.
You're quite a social media star, you know.
Oh, there's no doubt.
You get a lot of stuff going on in your page.
Social media is certainly a tool for us to reach our community. But what I saw in those messages, in those posts, were that Adrian impacted thousands of lives of teachers and students and parents while he was a school resource.
He cared. He really cared.
He was a gentle giant.
I remember him.
Yeah, gentle giant.
So I know we have to jump in with Lindsay in a little bit, but I just wanted to let our audience know, our listening audience, that we're talking to Sheriff Wayne Ivey, who is our sheriff here, the chief law enforcement officer here in Brevard County, Florida. And you are running for re-election. You've been the sheriff almost 8 years?
Seven and a half, yep.
Wow, time flies.
It does. It seems like just yesterday.
Yeah. So you and Junie, our dog, who's taking a rest. Oh, he scratched his ear. Now he's taking a rest. You guys went to Tallahassee, and you spoke to the governor about a bill that to include pets in domestic violence injunctions. Did it pass?
It did. It was actually a bill that was really the tip of the spear on this bill was the ASPCA. The bill was to include pets in domestic violence injunction orders. And when the team from ASPCA reached out for me out of Tallahassee to ask me to help with the bill, it was an absolute no-brainer, because what happens, and I know Lindsay can speak to this, what happens is in domestic violence cases, often there are extenuating circumstances that keep the victim from clearing themselves and being able to find refuge. And one of those things is their children. One of those things is their ability, in their mind, to be able to take care of themselves. But another big factor is their pet, because oftentimes the pet is used as a tool by the abuser to control the victim. It may be they threaten to kill the pet. It may be they say, you're not taking the pet. And the victim fears that the pet will not be cared for. And so this bill that was just a brilliant piece of legislation, we jumped on and helped push through, allows pets to be included in a domestic violence injunction. And it passed through every committee it was on with no bumps in the road. Junie and I were able to help sponsor it, help support it, do press conferences about it. And really and truly, it was Junie doing it. I'm just his Uber driver. That's all I am.
So, Lindsay, you could jump in here and tell our audience a little bit. What exactly is an injunction, and how does one file for it?
Okay, so thank you for allowing me to explain a little bit. So, a lot of states call them restraining orders. So when you hear restraining order or injunction, we're really talking about the same thing. In Florida, there's four types. There's a domestic violence order of protection that an individual can receive from a court. There's also a repeat violence / stalking injunction as well. There's injunctions available for dating violence as well as sexual violence. So there's four main types in Florida. Domestic violence is a fairly broad term, and it's broad for a reason, because the legislature wanted to include pretty much any type of violence, physical violence or threat to physical violence or threat of physical violence towards a petitioner. So it's a very broad word. It can mean, and a lot of folks don't, you know, when you hear domestic violence, you may think of punching, hitting, kicking, you know, real violence. But there's also just threats of violence. There's spitting. Talking about family pets, in the petitions, there is an indicator that asks if the person to whom you're seeking an injunction, if they have threatened to kill or harm a family pet. So that was always in there before, but a court couldn't necessarily award custody of an animal to a petitioner because they wouldn't have had jurisdiction to do so. So I think that bill enables the court now to address that. But there's four main types, and an individual that feels as if they need that, first step is to essentially go down to the clerk of court's office. I will say Scott Ellis and his clerk staff are extremely helpful when it comes to domestic violence injunctions, or really any type, but particularly domestic violence. A petitioner can report to any of the courthouses, Titusville, Melbourne at Neiman, Vieira, any of them. And if you're coming late in the day, I think they want you maybe to call ahead just so that they have somebody there, because I think they may stop taking them after a certain time. But they're extremely helpful. And yeah. You can go in and they walk you through the process.
We all know that preparation is the key to almost everything in life, right? So what does a person include in their petition?
Well, what I always say is, and this really goes for anybody writing a witness statement, you want to put in there your facts and your details as specifically as possible, your who, what, where, when, why, and how details. In injunctions in particular, what I look for when I'm reviewing them, when I'm either prosecuting them or defending them, I like exact statements. And a lot of times petitioners feel reserved about putting an exact statement in, so they'll say something vague like, he or she threatened me, but they don't describe what that threat was. Mm-hmm. So my biggest piece of advice is more is always better when you're writing an injunction. You want to include as much objective facts and details as possible. You also want to include prior acts, because oftentimes I've seen when folks come in to testify and to ask the court for an injunction, they will talk about the past and what happened prior to the incident that brought them into court. And if they haven't included that in their petition and there's an objection, then the court will sustain that objection and they won't be able to talk about it. So certainly I always tell folks, more is more. You want to put in there if there's been previous threats, if there's been previous violence, who witnessed those so that you know maybe who you need to subpoena to attend the hearing. If law enforcement was called out and if they took pictures, you know, I always would ask for copies of the reports, because I may want to, unfortunately, subpoena the officers to come in and testify about what they saw or what they observed. And if there was an arrest made, they can testify as to having arrested somebody. So you just need to be as thorough as possible. Pictures of injury is always something that speaks very loudly, whether you've taken the picture yourself or if you're going to the sheriff's office to get, you know, records that pictures that were taken by a law enforcement officer. But you have to be prepared and bring all of that with you.
Right.
Yeah.
And what does it mean if the court denies or grants a temporary order of protection?
Okay, so in Florida, we have an interesting structure here. So when a petitioner asks for an order of protection against domestic violence or any of the other types of injunctions, what the clerk's office does is they immediately send that, usually via fax, to the judge that's on duty that day that's reviewing them. And the judge will decide whether or not there's, on the face of it, what we call ex parte, because we're not hearing from the other side, whether or not there's grounds to issue a temporary injunction. You know, if there's been enough facts alleged that on the surface of the pleading would lead a judge to, you know, decide to do that. So if they enter a temporary, then there's going to be an injunction immediately in place once it's served by the sheriff's office, and it'll direct the respondent to come to court. Usually it's about 15 days after entry of the temporary. Now, if, on the other hand, the court denies a temporary, then the court will set what's called a return hearing 15 days later. So you still get your day in front of the judge to tell the judge what happened. But certainly if a petitioner can get a temporary injunction, that at least gives them that time to be able to collect their evidence, to be able to secure alternative housing if that's what they need, to
breathing space.
Breathing space.
You
absolutely
need that breathing.
Cooling down
breathing.
Period.
Yeah. Gosh,
and the children
need
may need it too. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a very important part too. Mm-hmm. Is there's a lot of different organizations out there that will help victims of domestic violence. Serene Harbor, the Women's Center. There's a number of other attorneys that will help them. Sometimes they feel trapped, and we just beg them to please look for these resources. Get to one of these shelters. You know, they take pets. If not, our team will come get your pet and keep them in a safe environment.
Yes.
What we want is that separation so that no one gets hurt, and then things can take their course from there.
Sheriff, talking about violence, recently you initiated a task force to combat youthful violence similar to the type of violence we're seeing taking place all across the country. Before we go to break, what is the task force and what are the main goals?
Yeah. So, you know, everybody's aware that we've lost several of our youth here in our community to violence, gang-related, drug-related. I'm talking about 19-year-olds, 18-year-olds. And the loss of any life is tragic. When you look at a life that was taken that early, it compounds that tragedy. And so the goal of the task force is to create a stopgap of that violence, to be able to not only identify who are those that are committing the violence, but to be able to identify those that we need to work to shield, to keep away from it. And so we're taking a multi-pronged approach of collecting intel, feeding that intel to our Game Over task force that is really going to pluck the weeds out of the beautiful grass, going to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll let our state attorney and our courts, our criminal justice system, deal with that. The other part of it is using some of the existing programs, the community relations officers that are embedded in these communities, and let them identify the kids that we can get to. Go back to what I said earlier. Let's get to these kids before they get to us.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And start working with them. We're engaging. I'm working on a pilot in Titusville, working with our faith-based leaders up there to partner them with our school resource deputies to be able to let the kids see their faith-based leaders and their law enforcement officers working together.
Hand in hand.
Obviously, two groups that they have dynamic trust for, their parents have dynamic trust for. They see them working together. It brings it all to the table. Working with coaches, mentors, teachers, to make sure that we're delivering opportunities to these children. And a lot of times people will say, well, is this kind of like police athletic league? Police athletic league is a great tool. Here's the downside. Not every kid's into sports, and so we got to make sure we're reaching every dynamic, those that are into the arts, those that are into music, those that are into videoing
right.
and games and stuff. We got to have a broad brush that gets to every single one of them.
Well, But you know what? I think people sometimes forget that we are the people who are supposed to shape the community in which we want to live in. And in order to do that, we have to stay engaged and involved year round, yep. Right? And I saw something on Facebook yesterday, and it made me think. It's deep. It says, somebody wrote, without safety, there is no freedom. And without freedom, there is no value in safety. So public safety is the number one issue.
Right.
No matter where you live.
That's right. Government's one and only responsibility is to protect its citizens. And people, regardless of their political affiliation, regardless of their upbringing, anything, they want to go to bed at night feeling safe and sound in their homes and be able to travel around and do and enjoy the great things that our country has to offer. So when it comes down to looking at what's priority, it's keeping your citizens safe. It's keeping them where they have the ability to learn. They have the ability to play. They have the ability to grow their families, to grow their financial abilities, all of it across the board.
Or to leave their homes late in the evenings.
Exactly.
I was just telling you all that, you know, I travel quite often. And when I go home to my birth country, which is Trinidad and Tobago, as much as the Commissioner of Police is doing his best there, there's still elements of crime. And I'm going to be honest, my sisters and my friends, they don't leave their homes in the evenings by themselves, right? Because it's very risky. The security is not like what we have here. I mean, we do go to bed at night, Sheriff, well, because you are keeping us safe. And thank you for that.
Yeah, well, it's the amazing men and women out there of all of our law enforcement agencies and our partners and brothers and sisters at Fire Rescue that are doing that job. They're the ones that are out there every day putting their lives on the line. And, you know, I will tell you, at one point or another in my 40 years as a law enforcement officer, I've worked in all 67 counties of the state of Florida. I've never seen a county. Yeah, I don't know if that's a blessing or a curse. I'm still trying to figure it out. But, I've never seen a county that loves their law enforcement officers like Brevard County does. Our deputies tell me that they can barely pay for their meals anymore. They go in a restaurant, an anonymous citizen is paid for it. The restaurant themselves is paid for it. The other day, somebody offered to pay for a meal. They were sharing this with me. They offered to pay for a law enforcement officer's meal, and they were told they were three down on the list, the waiting list to pay for their meal. So that's a community. And people do not realize how much that means to us, how much that means to these amazing men and women that are out there putting their lives on the line. It's truly an honor to serve here.
Well, you know what it is? It's leading by example, right? If a child sees a parent does that, then the child is going to do it as well later on. I see Lindsay shaking her head. You and I have had quite some conversations about child raising, and I remember the last time Lindsay was on the show, we had talked about my mom used to say, if you want to know about your children, look at your fingers. Not all of them are even. Every child is different.
That's a great point.
You just have to look at it, right?
Yeah.
And I think Paul wants to go to a quick break. We'll take a quick station break, Ellen.
Yes, we'll come take right a back. Quick station break, and then we'll be right back with Viewpoint with CETA and Friends right here on 1510 WWBC.
CETA and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of CETA McGee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters, and founder of Simply CETA Skincare, and these great sponsors. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 8 locations serving Brevard County. So if you have an emergency, need a physical, or when your doctor is unavailable, with 8 locations, MedFast offers top quality care that is close by and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MedFast, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. MedFast Urgent Care opens 7 days a week with the convenience of 8 locations serving Brevard County. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MedFast.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is CETA McGee on Viewpoint with CETA and Friends. We're back on with Sheriff Wayne Ivey, who's been our sheriff in town here for 8 years, top law enforcement officer. my friend Lindsay Sharp, an attorney at law here, and Ellen Little, my co-host. And we've got quite a packed audience with Brett and
Sean.
Brett and Sean. Yeah. And Junie.
And Junie.
They're all looking on. But, you know, as we went to break, we were
and
just
the
talking.
Junie.
Yeah, we were just saying as we went to break, you know, it raising a child is a difficult task. And, you know, people talk about the foundation for everything starts at home. But we all know not everybody has the luxury of having a father and a mother in a home for whatever reason, from divorce, single parenting, maybe somebody got hurt in an accident, whatever it is, grandparents are raising children as well. And Sheriff, you are starting a program about how to be a parent again. We do have people who are incarcerated and they're returning. We have people who are divorced and then by the stroke of luck, maybe they made up again, or maybe somebody got remarried, there's a second family. But whatever it takes, people need to understand that parenting is not an easy job. It is the most difficult job in the world. And before we use our reproductive systems, we ought to think about it.
I tell you, you make a great point. And you actually took the words that we actually start our program. It's called It's Time to Be a Parent Again. And I put the word again on it. We created it in-house. It's several years old. We created it in-house for the purpose of re-empowering parents. And the goal of the program was to give them a toolbox filled with tools. Not every one of them works on every kid. We talked earlier about the difference in raising kids. But you said something, and that is that parenting is a difficult job.
Mm-hmm.
It is a 365 days a year, 24 hours a day job. Probably one of the most thankless jobs in the world, but also one of the most important jobs any of us could ever have. Because in reality, as parents, we're tasked and charged and really given the opportunity to raise the next generation of parents. And we can't afford to skip a generation of parenting. We
right.
just can't. As a society, we can't. And so our program takes a three-pronged approach. One, parenting today versus yesterday, and boy, is it different. Two, the legalities of parenting. Our state attorney, Phil Archer, does a great job at sharing with our citizens, our audience, about what they legally can do as parents. And the last part is very unique, and that is we bring in our chain gang, which they volunteer to be part of the chain gang, and they volunteer to help us with this program. And they sit before the parents as a panel of experts, and the parents can ask them any question they want about where their life turned to crime. And these young men that are sitting there answer from their heart. And it's some of the most profound information these parents can ever get their hands on. And I'll tell you, it has had great success. We're able, through our faith-based organizations, to facilitate a lot of the training that we do with it. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to this. Re-empowering parents to, as you said, be the chief law enforcement officer in their child's life. Because in today's world, parents have three choices. They can tough love their kid, they can come visit them at the jail, or they can unfortunately go see them in the cemetery. And those are three.
And that's the
those
truth.
Those are three tough choices. And Lindsay, I know you work in this area a lot, and so I'd love to hear your input about.
Yeah, well, you know, talking about that, Lindsay, you see a lot in divorce as well, right?
Oh, absolutely.
We see a lot of fracturing of the family.
Absolutely.
A lot of loss, and unless someone acknowledges that we're getting a divorce, but this child has to be raised by both of us. Now, how do you when you see parents and you sit down with them and they have to figure out who's going to get the house, who's going to get alimony, who's going to get support, what is it about the children that you have to stress to them that this is the most important thing right now?
Well, it all starts with children and a parenting plan. And what the experts have tried to convey to us as practitioners in this area is to follow an acronym called PEACE. And the P of PEACE is for parenting plan. And to start with that, because everything else rolls after that point, as far as child support and some of the other issues that you mentioned. But when it comes to a parenting plan, what I try to convey to my clients is that it's really about what's in your child's best interest, not what may work for you, not what may work for your ex. And unfortunately, you know, we kind of alluded to this earlier, people can use children as leverage, talked about that with the pets.
Absolutely.
And frequently with children, what we see is this one parent will take an unreasonable position as it relates to a parenting plan strictly because that's that power and control. that we spoke of earlier. So I try to convey to my parents, there's two concepts in Florida law that we need to think about. The first is parental responsibility, which is the decision-making authority for a child. And typically, the legislature presumes that to be shared. And so courts presume it to be a shared parental responsibility situation. Unless it's detrimental to the child, and then the court can award one parent with the ability to make a decision. And we do see that in domestic violence incidences, because to make a shared decision means you have to be able to communicate with that other parent. And if there's been a history of domestic violence and a history of threats, well, then that's going to preclude that free flow of communication that enables parents to make joint decisions. The other component is the time sharing, you know, where the child lays their head each night of the week, who's at whose house. And so I think what we're seeing is with the research, and our legislature wants us to have frequent and continuous contact between the child with both parents. And that's actually what we're seeing works the best for children as well, for them to have dual relationships with both mom and dad. And usually that's through equal time or something similar to equal time.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people were very apprehensive about the 50-50. And I think it works. I really do. I have a lot of friends who are time sharing after divorce. And they recognize that the children fare better in life when they have a mom and a dad involved.
Absolutely. And so what that looks like, and it can look like any number of things, because oftentimes we have parents that are law enforcement, and so they may have challenging schedules to work around. I know firefighters have very challenging schedules to work around to achieve an equal time sharing plan. But it can look like any number of things. It can look like a week on, week off schedule. It can look like maybe mom has every Monday and Tuesday, dad has every Wednesday and Thursday, and then they switch the weekends. So it can look like whatever works best for your family, depending upon your work schedules and the child's
needs. But in order for all that to take place, you have to have a very important component called communication.
That's right.
And so
right?
important.
Yeah. And that is what we're lacking. Actually, we're lacking that everywhere, right?
I think there's another word. Your communication's vital. And listening to what Lindsay's saying about a lot of this things, you know, on the front end, making this creating the schedule and everything. But I know my two oldest children are from my first marriage. And one of the things that we always did was we, the parents, remained flexible. Because a lot of times I'll hear people say, well, you know, they can't play football because it interferes with my weekend, or they can't, you know, do cheerleading because it interferes with my weekend. And what I always remind people is, it's not your weekend, it's their weekend. And if you have to miss that, or, you know, get in the car and go to their game and pick them up afterwards, and remember that.
Oh, one drop and one pickup.
Remember that it's not your weekend, it's the kids' weekend, and your job is to give them the best life you can. And don't use them as a pawn. I think that's probably, you see a lot of that, I would imagine.
Yeah, we do. Unfortunately, we do. And, you know, we're not shy about correcting our clients and giving them the information that's really evidence-based. I mean, it's really at this point, because we've had at least 30 years of an uptick in divorces and the family court model changing, that we can look at the research and see what works for the children, so that they have the best outcome possible.
I always wonder why we have such an uptick in divorce, right? Because people spend all this money to have the wedding of their dreams and the wedding dress. And, you know, you watch all these shows on TLC, pregnant at 16, you'd say yes to the dress. They're marrying somebody in India when the girl is 60 years old, marrying somebody 23 years old in India or any other country. And you see all these things, and they spend all this money to get married, and then it's a divorce, right?
Absolutely. You know, I
it's like,
that.
Well, like, why don't they just sit down and talk about these things ahead of time?
Well, they're focused on the wedding, not on the marriage.
That's right. It's almost like they want a party. So have a party without having a piece of paper signed.
Exactly. You know, and you bring up a great point, too, about what we see our children are seeing today.
Oh, social media.
Yeah,
yes.
Not just social media, but TV as well. If you think about the programs that we all watched as we were kids growing up, I'll guarantee you if I went around the room and asked, somebody would say the Brady Bunch. Somebody would say Gomer Pyle. Somebody would say this and that.
Starsky and Hutch for me.
Starsky and Hutch. Gilligan's Island. All of these things.
Yeah.
All of them were wholesome shows.
Family values.
Yeah. Even the Brady Bunch had wisdom beyond their years.
That's right.
They were talking about blended families. And what you look at today is the shows you named off. You know, 16 and pregnant.
I mean, and the people,
you know,
are so proud.
Housewives.
Yeah, they're so proud to be pregnant at 16.
Yeah.
And their friends are throwing them a baby shower. Now, I remember back home in Trinidad, if you say I'm having a baby, you better be married, of course, things have changed. People now have children outside of wedlock, and it's acceptable in a lot of cultures. But I remember my father would say to us, put the fear of God in you. Who is raising the child? That was it. And that sent shivers down a young man's back, because he would say, "You, if you can't feed the child, you have no business bringing one into the world."
Right.
But we, I mean, at some point, all of us collectively have to say, wait a minute, use your reproductive systems in a very responsible manner, because if you bring a child into this world, you are responsible to feed it, clothe it, educate that child, make sure there's a safe environment, make sure there's somebody to take care of the child. I mean, society is there and government is there to help you, but they're not your parent, right? And I think that's where we miss it. All of us, we're so afraid to be politically correct that we don't say the correct things, which is be careful.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned earlier about it's not just parents, it's grandparents. Today's world, there are a significant amount of grandparents that are raising their grandchildren. In Brevard County, there's an amazing resource out there. And there's others, but I know one that we work with all the time is grandparents raising grandchildren. And they don't just, I think last number I knew, there was over 800 grandparents that were raising their grandchildren.
Challenging. It is very challenging.
There's some great grandparents that are raising their great grandchildren. And so, again, it goes back to what resources are available, goes back to education and awareness, goes back to somebody wasn't responsible for the child they brought in, and here's grandma or grandpa or collectively grandparents that are now doing it.
So what do you hear when you, Sheriff, when you talk to the young men and women who are incarcerated? You probably hear a lot of life stories that are heart-wrenching about someone not being there for that person.
Yeah. You know, when we do the presentation of It's Time to Be a Parent Again, the things that are usually missing, this comes from the mouths of the inmates that are sitting on the stage as again, a panel of experts in that field. The things that were missing were parental oversight, accountability, faith-based lives, not being their academic challenges. One of the things we notice is that around seventh grade, if they start to struggle in school, they start looking to elsewhere for approval, looking to the wrong crowd for approval. And that's a key factor in that drop in how their life goes. Drug usage, alcohol, those are the things that they
and that leads to a bigger question about mental health in our society as well. And I know, Lindsay, you see a lot of that during divorce, and when people are getting divorced and you're trying to talk to them about what to do with their lives and stuff. I mean, we live in a society that is so reactive, not proactive. Like, yeah, we saw on TV recently and on social media, they were talking about defunding the police. The word was wrong. What they should have said was reallocate. Give some funds to places where we can help with mental health, homelessness, after-school care, and most important, you know, there are nursing assistants who are working for less than $12 an hour in Brevard County, Florida, caring for other people's loved ones, the front line in this COVID-19. Give them a check and say, hey, we know you're stressed out when you get home and you can't even take care of your own children. Here is a $500 check to say thank you. I mean, you're shaking your head. I mean, these are things, mental health issues that we all have to talk about.
Right, because, you know, the impact of divorce or just the breakdown of a family, if you have an individual that already had a susceptibility to that emotional stress, well, then it's going to aggravate it, because usually divorce doesn't make our lives easier, at least in the short term. And I think that the other thing is to remove the taboo of seeing a therapist or going to counseling, because oftentimes I speak with my clients, even when I'm suggesting to them maybe doing some kind of marital therapy, and the feedback I always get is, oh, my spouse doesn't want that, or, you know, he's against therapy, or he doesn't say that, he thinks it doesn't work, or she thinks it doesn't work. So there is such a taboo when it comes to seeking mental health treatment and services that, you know, we also have to work on that it's not a sign of weakness, it's a sign of strength to reach out and say, I need to talk to someone who's professional and objective and can help me sort out these feelings. And
there's such a stigma, right?
And I'm going to say this too, and Lindsay, I hope you'll agree with me on this, but if not, please certainly say. But I think if you want to look at where we can start fixing some of our problems in society, some of the things that take away active shooters at schools and these other violent things that are taking place, is we as a society have to accept that our mental health system in this country is broken. Throw the baby out with the bath and let's start over. Let's come up with a new plan that is going to be better than the plan we have.
Well, talking about mental health, you know, animals do help people who are homeless. it helps people in our county here. We've seen who are depressed and have no one to look out for them. And so last week, the gentleman who was here, Alton Edmond, he had talked about you. He's running against you for sheriff. And he had talked about your team using the animals and not giving it to the appropriate people, mm-hmm. as in homeless people.
Right.
So what can you tell us about that?
First of all, that's a perfect example of why people shouldn't run for office that they have no idea about the office.
Yeah.
Because when you look in the animal services industry, what you'll see is there are a number of effective programs out there that actually partner homeless pets with homeless people. They become companions. Programs across the country that actually do that. And the first thing that comes to my mind, and I rarely listen to anything he says because he's really clueless about what this job is. But here's what I'll tell you. When my team called me and told me what he had said on the show, the first thing that went through my mind is, who is he to judge a homeless person and their abilities to care and love for something? I don't think any of us sit in that judgment for somebody. Second thing is, when you become homeless, that doesn't mean you give up your rights. It doesn't mean you give up your abilities to enjoy things.
Sometimes that's all they have to love is a pet.
That's all they have. And studies have shown that homeless people actually take great care of their pets because they're their companions. They're their best friend. They're their life. And the reality of it is, when you have a homeless person, we want to do everything we can to be compassionate for them, to protect their rights, to protect them in every capacity.
And to find them a home, most important.
And to find them a transitional home that they can get into and mm-hmm. get back on their feet. And to sit here and say that a homeless person shouldn't have a pet, that's appalling to me. And again, it just goes down to, if you want to do the job, you need to have experience to do this job because it is a very demanding job. And that's one of the things, as I said earlier in the show, I've been blessed to do this job.
Yeah, and you've been our sheriff for 8 years. What made you decide to run again for it's a third term, right?
Third term.
And I see you out in the community every day doing stuff for people, for the community. How what's the balance and act there?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, as I said earlier, I love this job. I get up every morning. I can't wait to put on the same uniform that the amazing men and women of our agency wear. You know, a lot of people say you're at every event. You go to this and that. I said from the very beginning, it takes a community to protect a community. And you can't just look at saying we're going to protect, keep evil away from your door. You have to work with our local organizations to help raise money to feed homeless children, help raise money to help our domestic violence shelters, and help other organizations that are helping us with our pets and everything else. And so the job requires that. It requires that kind of commitment. The good thing for me is I love it. I literally, it's the funnest thing.
Well, we know,
because
you're
done.
Always smiling.
I do. I have a blast.
If you love what you do, it's not a job, right?
This is what I said sometime back, and it really captures the essence of this job for me. This job's like going to Disney World for me. I waited my whole life to get here. I'm going to ride every
You have a life with purpose. You know why? Because you have a life with purpose. Yeah. So Lindsay, before we go, we have a couple of minutes left. One of our questions that I had gotten from one of my friends, we have 5 minutes? Oh, great. What does one do at a final hearing? How does a person conduct themselves? And how do you ask for a modification or an extension? Or maybe you want to have a rehearing. How does one do all of that?
So it's important to, when you are attending any court proceeding, to at all times try to maintain your composure as much as possible. And court is a very upsetting place, and it's difficult to do that. In our jurisdiction, well, it's statewide, but the deputies, the first thing they do is they play a video that goes over the process and, you know, even depicts exchanges between a judge and the parties. And they do that to educate the folks as they sit there, because everybody's nervous. But the biggest thing is to bring your evidence, bring your witnesses, and try to maintain your composure as much as possible and be respectful of the court. Whenever I'm defending an injunction, so if I have a client who's a respondent to an injunction and has had one served upon him or her, you know, we always go over what to wear to court, how to make positive eye contact with the judge, how to, you know, I don't want to hear a word out of your mouth, that speak when spoken to, you know, things of that sort, because unfortunately we make a lot of assumptions about people based on their body language and how they conduct themselves. And so to establish the credibility with the court, you need to be prepared to maintain your composure and to not interrupt the judge. That's probably one of the biggest things that I tell anybody in a courtroom is never interrupt the judge. And try to approach your case from a position of logic. You know, start with what happened and work your way back from there.
So respect.
Absolutely. Respect goes a long way in a courtroom. As far as changing an injunction, so assume for the moment we have an injunction that's entered by the court, and that injunction either needs to be extended, because oftentimes the judges will enter them for 1 year, sometimes 2 years, and we may need to extend that. So in that instance, the petitioner just files a simple motion with the clerk, and they'll get a hearing. And that's their opportunity to come in and ask the judge to extend it. Perhaps, usually a judge will extend it if there's been a violation of an injunction, or if the reasons for the entry of the injunction have not been remedied. So, for example, a judge can order a respondent to take and complete what's called the Batterer's Intervention Program, which is a 26-week program. If they haven't completed that program, well, that would be a reason to extend the injunction, because in theory they haven't gotten the rehabilitative services that that program provides for them. We can change injunctions through a modification. Oftentimes we have parents where one of them may be subject to an injunction and we may need to modify it so that maybe there's some form of controlled contact between the parties, or we need to change a time-sharing order by the court. And I recommend that always, because Sheriff is here. It's a first-degree misdemeanor to violate your injunction.
So give us your website.
Yeah,
quickly.
Absolutely.
We have 2 minutes left.
It is www.sharp.dye.law.com. It's sharp.dye.law.com. Deborah Dye is my law partner, and she has tremendous experience in family law as well. So either one of us are very helpful.
Oh, I know. I've sent somebody to you, and she's very happy. So, Sheriff, with the remaining couple minutes, quickly, how do we reduce inequality? Because we're seeing where social mobility is decreasing, the American dream is drifting further away, and we're seeing so many people who are struggling and facing challenges. How do you think, as in your role as the top law enforcement officer, what can we do to help?
As a community?
Yes.
I think it's all about what I said earlier. It takes community to protect a community. We need to try and help those that are struggling. We need to try and all work together as great partners. You know, I heard somebody say one time that there's all sorts of ships in the ocean that go through rough seas, but nothing plows rough seas like friendships, partnerships, and relationships. And I think that's what we got to
right.
make sure we're staying on top.
And we've always said on our show, you know, as long as we have faith, family, a few trusted friends, a little finances, and a little food on the table, and we have the ability to forgive, we're good. Right, Ellen?
That's right.
And also, you know, for all of us who are tuned into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends today, we all learn from history, each other, life experiences, and we learn from getting to know our neighbors. So vote, Sheriff, on
Absolutely.
November 3rd.
November
you don't have 3rd. A primary. You're
don't,
going
don't
right
have a primary,
on to November
right
3rd.
To November 3rd.
And Ellen, take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. But make sure that you tune in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends each and every Monday at 1 o'clock. We have all of our shows posted, as this one will be, as the Facebook Live that we did earlier. That'll be posted on our website, sitamedia.com.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you coming on, and you,
Thank
too,
you.
Lindsay.